killer robots sends out in what seems like a bit of an overreaction at the time to kill every single podcaster. But no, they could not differentiate between humans and podcasters, and so humanity is enslaved in this new dark future. Now, the future versions of Rob Wickens and myself, Clive Ashenden, are now about to be sent back in time by Dr. Serena Williams, the renowned scientist and inventor of the time machine, to find her father in the year 2014, Graham Williams, to record the podcast that just might save humanity. They found us, Saren! Saren, push the button now! Push the button! To the
that went well, didn't it?
Okay, and deep breath.
Hello, welcome to the Excuses and Half Truths presents Rob and Clive Speakeasy Pod of Future Cast.
Yes, the Pod of Future Cast, and we are together with a special guest, Mr. Graham Williams.
Woo!
Yes, it's the Welsh Wolverine himself.
Hello.
Hello. Comics fan?
Very much so.
Superhero fan?
Very much so.
Wolverine lookalike?
10 years ago. Half a stone ago, yeah.
Graham is here to talk about the Uncanny X-Men story arc, the Days of Future Past, which is now the kind of inspiration for the new Marvel feature film, which was... our number one draft pick in last month's podcast about summer movies.
Yes, we're all very excited about this. As our usual time travelling issue will make clear, we've not actually seen it yet because it's not actually out until tomorrow. So,
well, actually, it's out today.
Is it out today? Oh man!
It's funny when you get sort of jumped back in time into your body, you're all out, aren't you?
See, I'm completely confused. I don't know whether it's today, tomorrow, yesterday, this time last week, or 1947.
Yes. Which timeline are we on? Answers on a postcard, please, on a blog.
As long as it's not the darkest timeline, that's the main thing.
It's always the darkest timeline. But. On the good news side, so we're going to be talking about the original Chris Claremont, John Byrne comic, but before that, we're going to do some quick 50-second flash reviews of comics which are out now to buy now in 2014.
Yes, we've had a quick shifty through some of the new and interesting stuff that's out to buy now in your comic shops or through your favourite comic app. Comixology or whatever you fancy. If you'll excuse me a sec, here we go. Just getting the 50-second clock up because, of course, we believe in doing these things short, sharp, quick, and swifty.
Yes, kinda, sorta.
Kinda, sorta.
Yes, we do. And so rather than throw our guest in at the deep end, we're gonna show him how.
How we do it.
How it's done professionally. No, we're fine now. Anyway.
Because we're pros. We're pros, damn it. We've been doing this for long enough now.
You've even got notes, haven't you, Rob?
Yes, I have written...
Good man.
...written a note.
Okay, so what are we hearing about first?
Okay, I'm starting. And I'm starting with Moon Knight, the Warren Ellis and Declan Shavely version, the hard-boiled take on Marvel's white-garbed protector of the night. As ever with Ellis, some interesting stylistic experiments. The mass sniper shooting in issue 2 is doing things I genuinely haven't seen in mainstream comics before. And Shafley's art, which takes the colour completely out of the Moon Knight costume, is world-class stuff. There's hints of what we're likely to see in terms of Mark Spector's evolving schizophrenia, but Ellis's trademark decompressed storytelling means this isn't just a fast read. you feel a bit shortchanged by all the single page splashes. It's bold stuff, but it's a bit early to see where it's all going to go. The counter has spoken. Clive, you're up.
I'm up. Harbinger from Valiant Comics. I've been hearing a lot of good things about Valiant Comics in terms of if you're interested in kind of superhero stories, but you don't want to get bogged down in the endless continuities which have been laid down for years and then rebooted and then rehashed and changed every few years from Marvel and DC. I've been told Valiant's the way to go, so I thought I'd try Harbinger, which is a team book. It's almost like, I guess you could call it X-Men meets Scanners. Everyone's kind of abilities seem to be kind of psionic based, or as they call them, psyots. And we have a kind of government conspiracy set up a school like the X-Men, only it's a sinister school. So a group breakaway call themselves the Runaways and try and bring down the system. And yeah, that's worth checking out.
Sounds interesting. Sounds a lot like the Runaways, actually, the Brian Vaughan series.
Yeah, there's definitely kind of elements of that.
Mm-hmm. Cool, sounds fun. Check it out.
Cool. So, Graham, I understand you've got some DC goodness for us.
I do indeed. Been into Batman Black and White for a few years now, but haven't really been able to afford to buy these comics each month, which is a shame, so I've kind of waited for the volumes, the compendia. Yeah, I guess I've splashed out a bit over the last 6 months or so. And this version here has just come to an end. This was a six volume series. And what Batman Black and White is, in case you don't know, is a set of short stories written and drawn by artists and writers who don't usually collaborate. And what you get is obviously a totally interesting mix of stories and, of course, artwork as well. Thoroughly recommend anyone to check them out, even if you're not usually a DC or a Batman fan. Yeah, just loving them.
Cool. So this is the third volume?
Well, I was checking out the old Wikipedia the other day, and they said that three volumes already happened, so I'm all kerfuffled and with this. So basically, I have to say, they
do look gorgeous in terms of the artwork. It is, as you might expect, all black and white.
Indeed, yeah. And the writing is outstanding. There's some, not in these particular ones, from the legends of Neil Adams and Chris Claremont himself as well. These guys are legends and they're still writing, and they're writing excellent Batman shorts. They're all a bit different. Quick recommendation though, not in this one, in the first ever volume, my favourite of all time. I even gave it to my wife, who's not a comic book fan, and she even got it and enjoyed it. It was a story by Neil Gaiman and penciled, and inked by Simon Bisley.
Yes, I've got that volume. That is an absolute cracker.
Yeah, and just a left field, proper Gaiman-esque story, not your usual Batman canon, but fits well, I think, Mr. Wiggins.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely right there, Mr. Wiggins.
There you go. A bit longer than 50 seconds, but I guess I'm a guest. I can get away with that.
I think it was 50 seconds on the current volume, and then you did another few more seconds.
A bit more. That's fine.
Rob, what more goodness do we have?
One more from me. We're talking Rat Queens, which is an indie book. It's up for a Harvey, and I think for an Eisner as well this year. So it's got some real fan heat and critical acclaim behind it. It's hilarious, bawdy, gory stuff set in a fantasy realm and based around the four rat queens of the title, who are a kind of a gang of four female miscreants brawling, boozing and bonking their way through the market town of Palisade. As a plan to get them to work for the common good goes horribly wrong, the Rat Queens find themselves up against pretty much everyone. Everything about this book is completely spot on. Plot, dialogue, characters, art, you name it, buy it, read it, it's great. So there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Clive? Go.
Future's End. One of the new 52 from DC. I got special edition number 0 as part of Free Comic Book Day, which is a yearly thing you should look out for at your comic book shop. Now, ask me, see if this sounds at all familiar, bearing in mind what we're going to be talking about. 35 years into the future, giant killer robots are hunting down every superhero and kind of either eliminating them or herding them into camps.
Well, that's new.
That sounds strangely
doesn't
familiar,
it though? Very much a homage to Days of Future Past. The difference is, in this case, obviously, it's DC heroes and the robots are kind of arachnoid robots, which sort of transform you into kind of Borg cyborg things. Yes.
There we go.
It's not terribly inspiring. Basically, you've got Batman Beyond, Batman of the Future, Terry Malloy, and he gets sent back in time, as you might expect, to change this timeline, but in a massive twist, he doesn't go back to the right time. So he's sort of like 10 years too late. So things are already underway. So how will he undo the future that's come to pass? But if you want to see your DC heroes eviscerated, change, turn into strange cyborg spider things, then it's worth a look, I guess.
Sounds like a must avoid.
Yes. One more. Very quickly.
Right.
Well, 50 seconds quickly.
Okie dokie. Right, straight off the top of my head, this one. I want to talk about Adam Warren's Empowered, which recently came to a head with Book 8. These are basically graphic novel sized stories of a superheroine who loses her powers whenever her costume, which is kind of an alien inspired sort of all over bodysuit, gets ripped, which happens pretty much all the time. It's a really incisive commentary on the role of the female in superhero comics and about sort of gender politics and things like that, but at the same time it's also really funny. It's incredibly well drawn. If any fans of Adam Warren would know what to look for. It's great stuff. Again, there you go. Clive's last one.
Yep. Okay, lastly, but by no means least, The Amazing Spider-Man. It's been rebooted again, number one.
Oh, so how many number ones has that been?
I don't
More
want
than
to think about it. Basically, if you've been at all following Marvel's continuity recently, okay, let me read what it says here. After swapping his brain into Peter Parker's body, one of Spider-Man's greatest enemies, Dr. Octopus, set out to prove himself the superior Spider-Man. He also completed Peter's PhD, fell in love with a woman named Anna Maria Marconi, and started his own company, Parker Industries. But in the end, Doc Ock realised that in order to be a true hero, he had to sacrifice himself. Now Peter Parker is back. He has a new lease on life and absolutely no idea what went on while he was gone.
Reboot!
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this comic. It's massively good fun, and it's a huge bumper first issue, so it's a very good jumping on point. I'm very tempted to jump on. It's...
Okay.
It's super fun.
Not spider fun, super fun.
It's both super and spider fun.
Spiderific.
Okay.
Lovely.
Onto the business at hand. Let's keep it Marvel. And we're going to be delving back into the 1980s, aren't we?
We certainly are. Back to, I think it was 1980 actually, then. This particular...
Yes, 1980.
Magnum opus was first revealed to the public. Days of Future Past, the uncanny X-Men go back in time to save the future.
They do, or at least one of them does, anyway. this appeared in issues 141 and 142 of Uncanny X-Men.
And yeah, named after a Moody Blues concept album, Days of Future Past, P-A-S-S-E-D. So even ties back to our recent concept album podcast. It's almost like we've somehow planned this weird synergy.
It's all noted down in a battered black notebook somewhere.
So I guess a little bit of background for people under a rock who don't know who the X-Men are and what the hell we're talking about, maybe.
Okay, so, well, blimey, there's 60 years of continuity.
Let's just sort of... So we're not going to go through the entire 60-year continuity.
It would be... there'd be a long podcast.
But the X-Men are a team of mutant superheroes, which means in the Marvel Universe they're born with the X gene that allows the mutant to naturally develop superpowers which normally manifest at puberty. Not to be confused with, and I know you're all thinking it, Marvel's mutates, who are characters who develop their powers after exposure to outside stimuli or energies. So, Spider-Man, Hulk, Fantastic Four, and the like. Why is this important that they're mutants? Well, it's one of the main themes of the book is persecution of people who are different, born differently. And so that's what mutants are.
It also... It's always been interesting the way that the mutant power reveals itself as puberty, as if you didn't have enough to worry about with the growth of strange hair in places you didn't think hair could sprout out of. All of a sudden, you potentially could have the ability to lift things with your mind or fire out of your nostrils or something like that. So it's always been interesting the way that X-Men kind of deals with that kind of, I don't know if fear is necessarily the right word, but certainly that concern in the minds of what would have at the time have been their target audience.
Yes, yeah, I mean, especially when it first launches, co-created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in 1963, the initial lineup, you've got Professor Charles Xavier creates this safe haven for mutants at his Westchester mansion. Under the guise of a private school to teach young mutants to control and develop their powers so they can be used for the betterment of humanity, mm-hmm. and so they don't turn into evil mutants like Magneto and the like. It's very black and white, this comic book world, as you might imagine. So although, as you go through their continuity, it's funny how often the quote-unquote evil mutants end up joining the X-Men at one stage or another, or teaming up with the X-Men. As we see in Days of Future Past.
Indeed. In Days of Future Past, we get the kind of... it's kind of gathering together against a darker foe, if you like, which in this case are the Sentinels.
Yes, indeed. But before we get too much into that, let's turn to our guest, Brian.
Hi.
Hey.
Tell us about your first kind of exposure to the X-Men and this story. I mean, when did you first start reading the X-Men?
X-Men themselves. Mm. Well, a little bit of background on comics and me. I wasn't really a comic reader as a child, nor as a teenager. Apart from obviously the Beano, and then I became famous for about 15 minutes at school whenever I bought Biz in. And loved it, and I was like, oh wow, that's cool, and then everyone go over it. But no, I went to uni, some friends there introduced me to some comics, then I kind of got into them while I was at uni, you know, how it is in university where you just have lots of time on your hands.
Sure.
So you get reading, and you know, there's this escapism. So, you know, early 20s, there was a bit going on there, but it primarily was Vertigo DC then. Spider-Man had always been in my life, because I'd worn hats of his and t-shirts and had a helicopter and a car when I was a child and slippers and all the rest of it.
So it's all about the merchandising.
It was the merchandising, as you see these days, yeah, as well. So that was my past. Now in the future, yeah, merchandise is a big thing. Merchandise and the films were also a big thing for my introduction to the X-Men. And Marvel in general, because you said Spider-Man was just that, but no comic. No, doesn't really do you read the comics. And then Spider-Man came first as a Marvel experience, and then X-Men came into my life in my 30s.
I'd moved to London, I had my midlife crisis early, and I just got into comics in a massive way. And you think, oh, what's the correlation? Well, I just think that, yeah, maybe it was that escapism, but I just started to appreciate what had been written there. I'm talking about not just your amazing Spider-Man, Uncanny X-Men, you know, from the 60s, but you started to have the Ultimate series as well, which would be more glossy, up-to-date, and they just started talking to me a bit more, as in I could relate, I guess, a bit more, you know, a lonely guy in London, which many of us had some trans tribute, and actually being a teenager. Yeah. I could remember my teens just about. So the X-Men came really late in my life, really. I said, but the portal really for Marvel was Spider-Man. Really got hooked into Stan Lee's humour, where he was going with characters. You know, he wasn't afraid to actually beat up his characters, not just physically, but mentally as well. So when it came to the X-Men, I have to confess, it was the Ultimate X-Men first. I was curious. I really wanted to know what the origins were. By hook or by crook, begged, borrowed and stole from people who I hope can forgive me now. the originals in some form of electronic or actual comics or even compendia. And so I just got it. And to be honest with you, right from the beginning, this will come as a bit of a shock possibly, I was really disappointed with the X-Men. Yeah, because the movie had come out, it's a big fanfare.
The original ones.
And that put me off X-Men for a good couple of years. So back to Spider-Man, found other comic heroes from other places like DC, Image, for instance. So Marvel was still around the Spider-Man icon as well with powers. So I was getting into all of those, and then I said, right, okay, I'm going to give this a go again. So I read up on it, and I thought, because we didn't have Wolverine, we didn't have Nightcrawler then, we didn't have Colossus then, Storm. Yeah. The really cool ones from the film, right? I then read and learned there was a reboot.
There was.
75.
Yes.
Where I was born. Okay. So I'm not sure if there's any kind of, you know, synchronicity.
Just stack up all
yeah,
the time.
Basically what happens is that the X-Men in their initial incarnation are a very white bread team.
White bread, the Iceman, isn't it?
Yeah.
But for a book that's all about diversity and about persecution of people who are different, the initial lineup is operating on a very metaphorical level, because everyone is sort of white and American, and that's that. So when we come, you have Cyclops, Angel, Iceman, Beast, and Marvel Girl, and obviously Professor X behind the scenes. This isn't a particularly popular superhero title. So what happens is due to low sales, it basically gets sort of effectively cancelled and puts into turnaround. So you get old issues just being reprinted again as X-Men 67 to 93. But yeah, as Graham was saying, in 1975, it gets rebooted in giant-sized X-Men number one. So writer Len Wein and artist Dave Cockrum, and basically they reimagine it as a kind of new, more diverse, more international team. And older, so they move away from the kind of teens at school thing. So obviously Cyclops is still around when they reboot, but you get Colossus from the Soviet Union, Nightcrawler from West Germany, Storm from Kenya, you get Thunderbird, a Native American from the Apache Nation, who in retrospect looks rather, it's one of those sort of depictions of Native Americans which isn't terribly sensitive. Culturally sensitive now, but at the time it was pretty progressive, so we'll give him a little bit of a pass there. You get Banshee from Ireland.
Bigora.
And Sunfire from Japan, and of course Wolverine from Canada. So it gets the reboot with this new team, this new, and it goes along for a bit, and it's still very much the sort of redheaded stepchild of the Marvel Universe. But what that means is that the powers that be at Marvel just kind of don't really pay any attention. So the creators are able to be sort of basically do whatever they like and sort of change things up. And the series really kind of goes on fire when writer Chris Claremont, who ends up writing the book for, I think, was it 13, 14 years, something like that.
No, it was 16.
Yeah. There we go. See, that's why he's on the podcast. The man in the know.
Thank God we've got a fact checker on board.
Exactly. So, Chris Claremont comes on board, and you get artist John Byrne, and we start to get some major kind of landmark story arcs, things like the Proteus saga, the Phoenix saga, and then the Dark Phoenix saga.
Yeah.
And which brings us up to 1980. We're just coming off the back of the Dark Phoenix saga. Marvel Girl, Jean Grey is dead.
For the first time.
Spoilers. Oh yeah, by the way, everyone, spoilers for the Bronze Age of Marvel Comics.
I absolutely refuse to issue a spoiler alert for a book that came out in 1980. I'm sorry, not happening.
Well, and hey, if you're worried that we might spoil the film for you, we haven't seen it, so we don't know.
We have seen the trailers.
But the trailers would indicate that it does share a lot of story elements in common. So if you're worried, then, you know, pause the podcast, go and watch the film, come back, join us.
Yes.
Cool. Okay, yes. So, 1980. So Cyclops has basically taken a leave of absence because he's so devastated over the loss of the love of his life.
For the first time.
Jean Grey. And what I love this is a very, in a very kind of sort of I guess Kung Fu the series way, he's decided to walk the earth. he's decided to walk the earth.
He's gone to find himself.
Yeah, he's gone to find himself, man. To find someone incredibly inappropriate to fall in love with, because anyone who knows Cyclops will know that he is the most angsty kind of character going, who is a really tortured love life. It basically keeps falling in love with different versions of the same woman over and over again, and then things go very, very bad.
Well, surely here's a theory straight off the top of my head here. Shouldn't somebody, and especially a hero, be doing that on our behalf? Shouldn't somebody be having inappropriate relationships with pretty much the same type of woman over and over again? So he is suffering on our behalf.
Wow. Yeah. There you go, listenership. Cyclops literally taking one for the team. So, yes, Cyclops has left, which leaves Storm as the new leader of the X-Men, and she's kind of still finding her feet. She is ends up being an incredibly strong, badass leader, especially into the kind of the main part of the 80s, into the what they call the Copper Age, and into the 90s. So the team in the present day, 1980, when we start the Days of Future Past arc, and I guess we should kind of address the fact that this is only two issues of a comic book. It's like normally when we talk about these kind of landmark story arcs and stuff, it's like, you know, they go on for years, or that they're the massive kind of cross multiple books. When you come onto later things like Inferno or the Age of Apocalypse, then it's like that they just go on for ages, don't they?
So what you've got here is something that's got an incredibly huge reputation, but it's an incredibly compact story. As Clive says, it's literally two issues long. The trade paperbacks or graphic novel versions that are labelled as Days of Future Past have
they basically bulk it out with lots of the issues which kind of come before that, the ones that introduce Kitty Pryde, who's a very key character in Days of Future Past, and basically who's only recently joined the X-Men. So, and also a few other bits of fun stuff. And even some of the hardcovers will also have some of the various sequels which we'll come into, I guess, as we go on. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 1980, at the moment, the team comprises of Storm as our leader, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Kitty Pryde, later to be known more famously as Shadow Cat, but at the moment she's going under the rather naff name of Sprite.
Oof. Fizzy.
Yes, and she's only just joined. She's like 13 or 14 years old. She's very much the young sort of rookie in the team. And also you've got original X-Men Angel.
Yes.
And Professor X, is he dead? Remind me.
He's alive again, but again, he's taken kind of a leave of absence. He's not really in Days of Future Past either.
He's in 1980, but in the back of a courtroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. As ever with Xavier, he gets stitched up really easily. Well, you would really. If you're an old man in a wheelchair,
it's not just that, Professor X is basically one of the most powerful mutants in the Marvel Universe. So when you have someone who's so powerful, what they tend to do is basically hobble him so that they can get on with the real storytelling. But it's like having Superman in your story, you know. If Superman turned up every time Batman was about to have a fight, then it would get really old very quickly. Batman wouldn't have any challenges because his pal Supes would just come along and flick everyone with his little finger and then save the day, because he's so strong and powered and overpowered, one might say. Yes, so we have the team in the present, and yeah.
But the comics themselves don't actually start... No.
Now put yourself in the sort of shoes of a comic book reader in 1980. You've been following the massive Dark Phoenix arc and the sort of changes in the sort of team lineup, and so you know you pick up your X-Men book and you think you know what you're going to get, but then you open it and you're like, "Hey, what's going on? Who's this?" It's a really kind of discombobulating opening, isn't it? It's basically opening the far future. Yeah. I mean, I suppose we should take a moment to talk about the incredibly, well, iconic's an overused word, but I think you can talk about it in terms of the cover.
That cover is just extraordinary. It's been obviously parodied and referenced many, many times, but it reminds me to a certain extent of the Band on the Run cover of the old Wings album. You've got Wolverine shielding a woman who we now know to be Kitty Pryde, but we didn't actually recognize
Kate Pryde
in this, of course.
The kind of middle-aged version of Kitty Pryde.
Yeah. Under a spotlight, and behind them there's a huge poster with pictures of all the X-Men with things like slain, apprehended... Actually, just slain and apprehended.
Yeah. It's that thing. It promises. You're like, what the hell? What's this about? I mean, it's really striking. Yeah. And you know, you go through, and it's like literally like ticking people off a list: Cyclops slain, Colossus apprehended, Storm apprehended, Nightcrawler slain, Angel slain, Iceman slain, Beast slain, Sprite apprehended, Magneto apprehended. You know, you're going through all these ones.
You usually get. In the X-Men comics especially, you get a sense of danger and excitement from the cover and the first page anyway, but this one I think takes it to a even more dangerous, even darker level to begin with, because you usually get somebody dying or what have you, which then doesn't happen, but this right off the bat discombobulates you, but it really knocked me off my perch first thing anyway. And then into the comic itself.
Yeah, I mean, you hit page 4 of that first issue and you're confronted with a cemetery filled with the gravestones of not just X-Men, but most of the Marvel heroes. So people like Ben Grimm and Reed Richards are all in there. So basically, this is a book that's effectively said it's not just mutants that have been either apprehended or slain, it's most of the heroes of the Marvel Universe have.
Yeah, so we get introduced to Kate Pryde in the far future, and who's looking to meet up with Colonel Logan of the Canadian Resistance Army.
A.
A. fantastic. And we basically see that we're in this sort of bleak future world where everything's kind of busted and there's detritus everywhere, and they're being hunted down by these giant robots, the Sentinels, which if you're an X-Men fan, then you'll recognise from previous kind of stories. But for the benefit of those just kind of coming to this fresh, they're basically giant killer robots that were invented by a scientist called Bolivar Trask to hunt down and capture, initially, mutants. Now, it gets rather kind of tortured, the sort of the kind of timeline of them, but eventually that, but basically that gets turned into sort of capture and eliminate.
Mm.
You know, we start to get into kind of Holocaust metaphor here in terms of a people being hunted down, herded into camps, and eliminated.
To the point where the mutants actually have to wear a big letter M on the fetching green overalls and Uggs that they're all forced to wear. So yeah, I mean it's broad stroke stuff, but it does make its point that again, sort of taking the whole thing about persecution to another level. Really.
I mean, also we've spoken about how kind of compressed this is, the fact that it's two issues. I mean, it really does, I think, does it a great job, especially in those first four pages of kind of show, not tell. I mean,
yeah,
all right,
very
we,
much
we so. Get lots of kind of VO. I mean, Claremont is a slightly wordy writer, especially by today's standards, but they're good words.
Yeah, what I did find, when I did start to get into Claremont's X-Men, lots of exposition, but then again, because I was new to it, I guess I needed that help, I needed that nudge. And if you were looking through and you wanted to get on into these story arcs, then they did help. Granted, it could be a bit cheating, that somebody would actually give four panels of their life and who they are, what their superpower is. But hey, you caught up. But in this, I agree that it's punchy, it's there. It's actually a bit darker again, because I think there's a line that Kate write voiceovers to herself about how they're basically what he's inferring is that the Sentinel frisked her as well. You obviously don't see that page three or whatever, but when I read that again recently, a bit older and paying a bit more attention, I guess I was like, oh wait a minute, this is actually a little bit darker there. And of course, as I said about the graves earlier on, it's an amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's a frame, but it's low angled, and we've got friends there who are no longer with us, and we are then our imagination is allowed to go where it really goes. That's where I think Claremont does really well in this, on these issues. Mm. Then we have that. So from the start, we've got some darker than usual.
But it's a good point. Everyone always thinks of Claremont as kind of the writer that gives you more than you need. He's deliberately wordy. He's deliberately kind of throwing it all out there. But there's space to breathe in this story. As Graham's saying, although he's still giving you a lot, he's kind of paring stuff down at the same time, weirdly enough. So you're getting a lot compressed in. He's chucking an awful lot of information into these four pages, but he's still giving you a chance to sort of read more into stuff.
Of course, yeah, which is perfect for comics.
Yeah.
I can't remember who said it about you read a lot in between the frames, because your imagination is flying off there. And equally, and to be fair, John Byrne with his art as well, there's If you were a film student, you'd go crazy with all these angles here. If you're an editor, I guess you'd be even crazier again, because there's so many high, low.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of information visually conveyed to, which I really got from this. This is, even from the beginning here, was one of those, especially having read through the Dark Phoenix saga, shook me up a bit, to be fair. Mm. I'm a bit older now, a bit sturdy, but fair play. They shook me with this future world.
Yeah, I think you can see why. I mean, you can see even in just those first few pages why this story sort of resonated with readers, why it was popular, why creators came back to the world, to this timeline here. I mean, that's the other thing about Marvel is that once when they create a sort of dark future, they don't sort of just sort of go, well, that was a nice Elseworlds story, we'll just park that over there, that's not in continuity. They go, that exists, and it's just one of many multiverse sort of different parallel versions of the future. So as we go on, we'll find all these different alternative dark futures. There's the dark future of Age of Apocalypse. There's the dark future where Cable comes from, where Bishop comes from, who is appearing in the movie. So they're obviously conflating a few bits, and yeah, there's various other sort of characters who are from a future who come back into the past to try and stop things, change things. It's things start to get very kind of conflated with the Terminator and things like that. So yes, but yeah, going back to where we were in the story, we get introduced to sort of the future team. So we have Kate Pryde, as we're saying, Colonel Logan, the old Wolverine. We got old Magneto, who's now in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
nice touch.
In a nice sort of echo of Professor X. We've got Rachel Summers, who we later find out is Scott and Jean's son.
Daughter.
Yeah. Wow. I need to
name like Rachel.
Yes.
Yeah. This future, eh? It's a bit bizarre. Can I just quickly say the future is actually 2013 in this one. Yes. So that's last year. So, Clive, your little slip there actually could actually be relevant. Rachel these days could indeed be a he.
Yes. I have to explain that is like a sauna in the sort of recording studio today. In our sparkling Westchester mansion studio that we're in today. It is unbelievably warm.
This is the most comfortable stationary cupboard I've ever been in, and pleased to be here.
So I'm trying to excuse myself by the fact I'm slightly delirious from the heat.
I thought I'd try that with the 2013.
Yes. But yes, so yeah, this is the dark future world of 2013. It's a scary place, folks. You don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Can I just add one thing to the story as well, is that the mutants cannot use their powers through not just fear of death, but I think they have inhibitors.
Yeah, they've got inhibitor collars, which are kind of like dog collars, again, to sort of add to the whole dehumanising aspect.
Humans are enslaved in this future.
True, true.
Not just mutants.
If they do use their superpowers, then it would alert the Sentinels and death, or at least
death from above.
Some heavy bruising, some bleeding would ensue.
A very severe telling off would ensue.
So,
yes, they would be chastised.
Claremont has already cranked it up there again, you know, with the sense of just danger. But, you know, we're not actually going to see any superpowers then, are we?
Mm.
We've got these, what are now almost...
Well, except for Wolverine popping his claws and still being alive after all these years, I guess. Yeah, but it does seem to be like that's the setup. So, yeah, who haven't we mentioned? Oh, yeah, we've got Franklin Richards.
Yeah, Reed Richards' son.
Son. And,
son? Yes.
I think that's right. And Colossus, who like Wolverine, is sporting some fine kind of white hair, because obviously, as we all know, men when they age in the world, they just get sort of stripes of white going down their temples, and that's all, isn't it?
It kind of happens in two stages. You either get the sort of all over stripes sort of from your ears up to sort of temple, or you go completely white.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Right.
One or t'other.
Oh, I know. Actually, my dad used to do this. Did a lot of painting when he was getting older, and he wore a hat, so he used to get white in the sides just because the paint is black. Always right. So he didn't realise this. What happens when you get old?
So you're saying he looked like Reed Richards, basically?
Well, a bendy, stretchy man. Yeah, I just wish I had his physique. Yeah.
Yes, so we end this kind of this future world with Rachel Summers using her powers to send Kate Pryde back into the body of her past self, Kitty Pryde, in the year 1980, and we get a beautiful full page bit of burn art of Kitty Pryde walking into the danger room.
It's really nicely done because stylistically, from this, it's been sort of pages and pages of like 7-8 panel pages,
and they're all they're all kind of brooding sort of dark colour as well, aren't they? It's sort of like, you know, dark purples and I guess greens and things like that. Yeah. So it's all, you know, it's all grim and dark.
Yeah, and all of a sudden you get this huge, as Clive was saying, this big single page panel in the danger room, lots of bright colours, lots of action, and right in the centre,
lots of false perspective.
Oh yeah,
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and Kitty Pryde sort of standing in the middle of it, looking
innocent
and slightly confused about what's going on. It's almost like a jump cut. It's really beautifully done. Mm.
The danger room is basically, it's kind of Professor X's private little room where he trains his students. There is in the comic book Professor X a sort of slight strain of like, you know, well, we know he's a good guy, but he's also a bit of a what name sometimes, isn't he? You know, he sort of likes to kind of torture his students in order to kind of get the best out of them. Tends to sort of lies them often, fake his own death many times.
As Kitty Pryde famously puts it, Professor X is a jerk.
Yes. It's true, folks. He's not that sort of, you know, twinkling James McAvoy character you're going to meet in the film.
Oh, that lovely Patrick Stewart, again with the twinkle. It's all about the twinkle.
It's all about the twinkle. He doesn't really go with the twinkling in the comics. He leaves that to Dazzler.
Yeah. And on that, with Wolverine, hilariously, I'd forgotten before, he actually does call Professor X Chrome Dome a few times. Getting Wolverine.
Those were the days.
Yes, so the danger room is basically this room which is set up to sort of help train the X-Men so that they're at full peak when they go and fight against proper real supervillains and the like. So it's like things like big robots and blasts and things.
Weird spiked things coming out the walls. They're very good on weird spiked things coming out of the walls. I mean, the S&M imagery in the danger room is always a bit perverse.
I had never noticed that.
Really? Well, tentacles and strange fluids spurting out the walls.
We get this danger sort of situation of the new sort of innocent Kitty Pryde walking into the middle of this incredibly dangerous situation, but then wonderfully it gets turned into this great sort of joke, which is Kitty Pryde's mutant power is that she can sort of phase her body through walls and become like a ghost. So she just sort of phases, and all the sort of danger things go through her, you know. All those millions of dollars that Professor X spent on the danger room wasted. And yes, so she comes through okay and seems to be all right, but then she just faints dead away as future Kate Pryde jumps into her body.
So you get this wonderful moment where all of a sudden, Kitty Pryde doesn't really know the X-Men particularly well, and is kind of quite nervous around, especially Kurt Wagner,
Nightcrawler,
suddenly wakes up after a weird little trance and just acts like their long-lost family around Kurt. She's been very, very wary of him, and all of a sudden she just leaps into his arms.
Yeah. Kurt, it's you, really you, alive.
Yeah.
And immediately they're like, something's wrong. Maybe you want to have a lie down. So, yes, at which point she sort of starts to explain herself and they're like, oh, there's something wrong with her. She's having a mental breakdown. Let's get Professor X to sort her out. But then she goes into sort of telling. We basically get a sort of one page explanation of the entire timeline that's led to her dark future. So, Rob, do you want to take up the story?
Oh my God, it's so compressed. We've got like a sort of 7-panel page that just crams in so much information about effectively the death of.
Senator Robert Kelly.
Senator Robert Kelly, who fans of the movie will remember from the first film, basically turned into a lump of jelly and disappeared down a grating somewhere, was assassinated by a mutant of whom we will hear more later, which sparked off the signing of the Anti-Mutant Act.
But there was a lot of anti-mutant feeling and fear. To begin with, wasn't there? Yes. You'd had that previous, but here it's just massive spotlight on that. And you kind of see this with politics over the last few decades as well, especially in Europe, and obviously pre then too, with a lot of right wing factions and groups. Basically stirring up a lot of tosh and nonsense of a minority. So I got this. But this was in America as well, as America in the 80s, and you didn't have this. Again, because I wasn't around. I was in the 50s, 60s with the communists.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All that going on. Yeah. So I'm not sure if there was any of that happening or not, just going obviously to 1930s in Europe as well.
I think it touches on all that to a certain extent as well. Really? The fact you end up with these sentinels being effectively like these huge stormtrooper type characters, although admittedly in a very fetching kind of sort of pink and grey uniform.
Well, I actually saw a couple of
it's the Kirby design. The sort of lozenges over the eyebrows. It's a beautiful design.
We're in Farringdon now, really, and there's a few guys dressed like this. Big purple Uggs.
The Ugg boots again. But yeah, basically the centre. I'll quote directly from the comic here. The administration responded by reactivating the Sentinels. The robots were given an open-ended program with fatally broad parameters to eliminate the mutant menace once and for all. The Sentinels concluded that the best way to do that would be to take over the country. In the process, they destroyed not only mutants, but non-mutant super beings, both heroes and villains. By the turn of the century, the North American continent was under their complete control.
And you get this wonderful image of all these sort of heads of well-known Marvel Universe characters with crosses through them.
In fact, sentinel-coloured crosses as well.
Yeah. And at which point Kate Pryde and Kitty Pryde's body breaks down in tears.
Meanwhile, back in the future, we find Logan and... the rest of the gang being attacked by sentinels
because they've escaped from the camp and
resistance. They have a plan,
and we get the first of our incredibly brutal deaths in the future. Franklin Richards is eviscerated basically in a bastard pure energy by a sentinel,
zapped away by nothing.
Also in the future is Storm. Did we miss anyone else out?
It's
Storm.
A very trimmed down X-Men that we've
yeah, because basically everyone's dead already.
Pretty much, yeah.
So things are going extremely badly. But they managed to take down a few Sentinels, don't they?
They do. They've managed to one of the plans that they've managed to sort out is to. Neutralise the collars that they were wearing, so they do actually have their powers back, which means that Storm can fire lightning bolts at the Sentinels, and the reappearance of a fastball special, which is nice to see, where Colossus flings Wolverine at Sentinel's head.
Which fans of the movie might recognise from X-Men The Last Stand, probably the only good thing in X-Men
exactly,
The Last
Stand. Exactly, that really cool 10 seconds of what was otherwise a pretty poor interpretation.
Yep. Yes, let's not go there anymore.
Let's please not do that.
Let's just view it as a dark alternative timeline, which never happened. Yes, so then back into the future, we meet the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, the current version.
Back into the future, back into the past. We're back in 1980 now, aren't we?
Oh, I see. I'm all twisted around. Back into the past. Sorry. Yes, from the future. You got that? Back to the past, present, from the future, future. Yeah. Which is now the past because we're in 2014. Oh, so confusing.
Oh man.
Anyways, yeah.
Where are we?
Halloween, 1980, apparently in Washington DC, and we find that under her shape-shifting disguise is mutant Naoto Conway's Mystique, who you folks might recognise from the movies. It should be said that the comic book Mystique is somewhat different in that she actually wears clothes. For one thing,
well, boring.
Although drawn where your imagination can't go too wild.
Yes, she tends to affect a rather fetching white sheath dress with skulls belt, accessories, and also worth noting that the Mystique of the comics is one of the lesbian characters in the Marvel Universe.
Mm.
Which, rather sadly, they decided not to change for the movies. But there we go. So at this moment, the Mystique is the leader of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, which it's a bit on the nose to call yourself evil, isn't it? I mean, if you're...
That kind of, again, went back to the sort of Golden Age X-Men. They were always called the
Brotherhood. I think you mean Silver Age.
The Silver Age, excuse me. They were always called the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. It is a bit kind of on the nose, yes, but it does the job that it says on the tin.
Yeah, so we have, Mystique, Avalanche, whose touch crumbles any solid object, creating an irresistible avalanche tidal wave effect with earth, stone, steel, anything.
Good Lord.
It says here. Destiny, a blind precog with the psychic ability to see the future, the only member of the Brotherhood Raven calls friend. Says
why do precogs always have to be blind? I mean, I know it sort of goes back to sort of Greek mythology and sort of Tyrese.
That's why it goes back
to Greek.
Them's the rules.
Them's the rules. Oh.
Yes. Pyro, who controls living flame. That's all he gets. As an intro.
Later on, though, you do get he is English. And there's a bit of a David Bowie to him, after all.
Yes, he's got a wonderfully drawn sort of flame look blonde hair and eyebrows. He's got those sort of evil eyebrows, should we call them? The sort of like Magneto has, the sort of horned eyebrows type look.
They are extraordinary, actually. I really have to trim down these days. Being a gentleman of a certain age, I do have to sort of trim my eyebrows these days.
Yes,
I would end up looking.
Beetle-browed kind of.
Beetle-browed. There you go.
Magnificence. And lastly, you have the Blob, a man whom no physical force can harm because he basically absorbs you into his body. It's pretty gross.
There's an image.
Yes. There we go. So their cunning plan is they're going to assassinate, as we've established, the anti-mutant senator, but which then is going to lead to this alternative dark future. So, what happens next?
Well, explosions is what happens next as the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants break into the Senate committee where
Professor X is addressing.
A committee.
Along with Moira MacTaggert for X and uncanny X-Men fans, being Scottish, of course, with Taggart. But also, it says Professor X's ex-lover, but also it doesn't establish here Banshee's lover to mother of Proteus, was it? Yes. And all round good old gal,
But no action for these two, I'm afraid. It's all down to the young X-Men in this time.
Yeah, she also, I mean, she did appear in X-Men First Class, but again, that's a very much kind of like a pale imitation of what we've seen in the comics.
Yeah.
The Moira MacTaggert of that film rather got the poor end of that story. So, yes.
So did Scott Summers, Misty, everyone.
You name it, really.
Yes, so they bust in, and then the X-Men turn up to sort of save the day. So we get,
big old confrontation, just to end that first of the two issues. So
we end with a cliffhanger.
We end with a cliffhanger, and we begin the second part of the story with yet another classic cover. Just an amazing image of Wolverine basically being blasted to bits by a sentinel.
You literally see his flesh coming off his body. It's an amazing image. And also, in his other hand, he's holding the sort of limp body of Storm with what appears to be some kind of spear sticking in her.
Mm. And then the kicker is the text breakout, which says, quite simply, this issue, everybody dies.
And, you know, you're used to a bit of hyperbole with your comics, but really,
That's going to make you want to pick up that issue, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, there's none of this kind of supervillain sort of shaking his fist in triumph as we see the sort of comatose bodies of the superhero team around him, Malarkey, which we've seen many times. This is our heroes being brutally and ruthlessly exterminated.
Absolutely.
Which brings us back to the story. So we get a little recap, don't we?
Yeah. To the point, compressed, but it drags you back to the point where we get the fighting that we've kind of been waiting for a little bit for a chunk of last issue, where you have the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants up against the X-Men, and hoo boy, they go at it.
Yes, they do. And obviously, Senator Kelly takes this opportunity to sort of like tell the mutants how bad they are. You know, not recognising that his life's been saved or anything like that, because he's a bit of a
dumbass.
Yeah. They're all being naughty, aren't they? They're in court and they're punching each other,
yeah,
and blasting things and turning things into fire ice.
So you get some lovely kinetic John Byrne art here, and as they start to go at it, sort of beautifully rendered, sort of Avalanche using his powers. And then you've got Nightcrawler kind of bamfing all over the shop, and trying to sort of his power is that he can kind of teleport, so he just sort of teleports punches, but all within one panel. It's beautiful.
Mm.
So yes, it's a superhero book, and the heroes and the villains end up duking it out. Shock horror. But yes. But will that be enough? Because it's all been a diversionary tactic, hasn't it?
It has.
Yeah, because Mystique is not with the Brotherhood. She's off trying to do the dastardly deed.
Do the dirty. Meanwhile, back in the future, we have what's left of the X-Men trying to carry out their final bit of their plan.
Oh yeah, we should point out that their blind precog in the Evil Mutants has sort of noticed that there's something wrong, because he can't see the future. He or she.
And the friend of Mystique. And the
She can't see the future because of this temporal anomaly. Yes,
basically. Gotta love an anomaly, haven't you?
Yes. And she's talking about Kate Pride. Indeed, it actually says, and speaking of Destiny's temporal anomaly, and then we get a picture of Kitty Pryde, in case we didn't get it, so.
Doink.
And then we get a recap of how she got here, and then we go back, right, to...
Back to the future.
Back to the future.
Back to 2013.
Yes.
Those heady, faraway days.
Yes, so folks, you'll remember that we last in the future we saw Franklin Richards get killed. So now left of our merry band we have Wolverine, Storm, Rachel Summers, and Colossus.
They were trying to make their way to Sentinel Central, which is the Baxter Building. It's a kind of nice little... And that's something you tend not to get in the sort of the Marvel movies, this sort of counter-textuality where, well, to a certain extent, I guess it's happening a little bit with the Avengers, but you won't get, for example, Spider-Man meeting the X-Men or Spider-Man as part of the Avengers or anything like that, because different studios have different bits of the franchise, whereas here it's kind of nice.
And I mean, well, my experience kind of reading Marvel comics is that's often how I first met heroes. It's like I first encountered Nightcrawler in a Spider-Man team-up book, where, as you know, as is often classically the case, you know, Marvel hero mistakes Spider-Man for a menace, a villain, and decides to sort of stop this menace. And then they have a fight, but then they realise actually they've been duped by the real villain, and then they team up to take him out. It's you know, classic stuff, really is. There's lots of that going around, and of course, but I think my first exposure to the X-Men proper would have been in the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends cartoon.
Oh my God, that's a classic.
Indeed, the one where basically Spider-Man teams up with the X-Men to fight off the Juggernaut, and it's a really nice kind of story in terms of showing one of the good things that you don't really get in the movies too much, but you get it. But it's one of the lovely things about the book is that you see how they have special team moves and how they work together as a team, and how when they work together as a team then they win, but when they're fighting separately they tend to sort of get picked off. So it sort of has this underlying kind of theme of if when you come together as a family, as a team, and put aside all your differences, because there's lots of bickering and people falling in love with the wrong people or the right people, and sort of love triangles and things like that going on within a team, and rivalries. But
so soap operatic, really.
Indeed. But then they put that away, and so in this cartoon you had a really nice kind of sort of team strategy going on, and Spider-Man in the end sort of delivers the kind of coup de grace and takes off the helmet of Juggernaut, which allows Professor X to sort of mentally stop him. So yeah, and yeah, that's also notable for having an Australian Wolverine in it for some reason.
Looking into the future,
it's quite a
good point. Yeah,
I guess you'd call that a prescient glimpse, or you could call it like a really egregiously bad Australian accent. It's like you want a piece of fruit. It's like really it's like for some reason they made him Australian instead of Canadian.
Why?
I don't know. It's odd.
It's crazy.
Obviously, I didn't know any better when I first saw it. I was like, oh, Australians, he's an Australian. Great.
Yeah.
Is that like Quentin Tarantino in, was it Django Unchained, actually doing...
the worst Australian accent.
Is it supposed to be Australian?
Yes, it is.
Right,
it is.
Okay,
yes.
So maybe it's just some of the Americans.
Anyway,
so we're in the Baxter Building.
We're in the Baxter Building, which is a nice little throw forward. Well, it's just basically a nice little reference. The fact that the Sentinels have chosen to make their home in the most technologically advanced building in New York City.
Yeah, and in what what's a bit of a pleasant change. Our heroes in the future actually sort of manage to succeed to a degree against the Sentinels and get into the building without anyone dying.
Absolutely. So we're now into this kind of backwards and forwards fight sequence, if you like, between what's happening in 1980.
Yeah, basically they're doing this kind of cut forward and back, which is this really nice non-linear sort of way of telling the story. And which I'm guessing we probably won't get that much of in the movie. I know that when they adapted it for the 90s animation X-Men, they did a two-part adaptation, which actually ended up with Bishop going back in time instead of Kitty Pryde.
Bizarre.
Yes.
Strange enough, having Wolverine do it, but...
Yeah, or apparently Old Man Wolverine was too old. It's really ageist. It's appalling. It's also very 90s, isn't it?
It's got an awful lot of... there is much pouch action going on.
Yeah.
Even with the ladies, or were we just talking about in here?
I think everyone's got pouches on, haven't they?
Everyone's got pouches, or they're wearing leather jackets, yeah. or they're, you know, everyone's brooding angsty, or they're carrying a big-ass gun.
Yeah.
Even Bishop, who has a mutant power, carries a big-ass gun.
What is Bishop's mutant power? I've never been able to figure it out.
Oh. It's, It escapes me for the moment because all I can see him is just shooting people the whole time. But he does have a mutant
power. Maybe that's his mutant power, the ability to shoot people an awful lot.
Could be. Could be.
Bishop the mystery mutant.
Anyway, yes.
So we've got lots of fighty stuff. Again, very well choreographed. An awful lot of text for fighty stuff, but it still kind of works.
Yeah, you can skip by the text here. On your second or third reading, because it's just there's so much going on. You're picking back and forth in the future, and all these panels, as Clive mentioned earlier, with Nightcrawler, you know, 2-3 times in one frame,
yeah.
Bamfing all over the place. Good old Wolverine with it, snicking all over the place.
Snicking and snacking, actually. So I'd never figured that out before. When the blades come out, they snicked, but when they go back in, they snapped. I didn't know that one.
And what does Storm do? She breaks wind and causes hurricanes.
So yeah, we have Kate Pryde basically sort of leaves the X-Men to it because she obviously. It's got her mind on her main mission, which is making sure Senator Kelly doesn't get killed. And even though the X-Men are kind of getting their asses kicked a little bit, as we see, yeah, with this wonderful panel of Colossus getting thrown out of the building with a big whammo, which is a lovely bit of comic book dynamism.
Is it at this point, or was it earlier, that another surprising thing with Wolverine is that he actually says cripes? So Wolverine's, I guess, stock swear word for the comics there. Cripes. I picked up on that, and I'm going to use it from now on. Anyway, sorry to interrupt that.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Concussion Cannon, also, apparently, which has the same... uses the same energy principles as Iron Man's repulsor ray, strikes the deadly effect, and it strikes with the sound effect Zark.
Although the best sound effect of the whole sequence is Colossus actually putting the beat down on the blob, so the guy obviously can be hurt, or who knew. Krom. Meanwhile, back in the future of 2013, a year ago, we're back in the Baxter Building. We see the last of our heroes, Colossus, Logan, and Storm, trying to infiltrate the Sentinels. What do you call it? Inner Sanctum, only for it to go horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, it's like, oh, the only one guarding the incredibly important sort of central computer appears to be this low grade of Sentinel. Wolverine is rather confident he can take him on. So we get, again, the fastball special. We get Colossus tossing Wolverine up. you child. Throwing Wolverine at the Sentinel's head.
Well, actually, it does end in a splurge. So maybe Rob's.
See, I was right all along.
Oh dear. Yes, and then we get that devastating panel. The Sentinel reacts a fraction faster. Yerg,
and yes, poor Wolverine's basically turned into so much. Well, nothing really was all that's left of him is his skeleton.
To add insult to injury, the Sentinel monologues at the same time. Pathetic organic being, are you so arrogant as to believe you could even approach, much less penetrate our innermost sanctum undetected? It's like, he does it at the same time as he's eviscerating the guy. It's like, wow. You've got to love that Claremont monologuing.
That's live.
Love the Australian accent there, Clive, as well.
So the Sentinels are Australian as well now. Is that what we're saying?
So the X-Men try and fight back, but it's in vain.
It all goes horribly, horribly wrong. So
we get a rather brutal panel where Storm gets killed in.
In a very Frank Miller style silhouette.
She gets speared,
skewered, kebabbed.
At which point we get Colossus, in rage and grief, punching a Sentinel out of the building.
And then, weirdly enough, he dies. But it's done kind of off panel. It's something that. Rachel Summers feels in her mind, but is never actually shown. He just goes.
Yeah.
It seems a bit sort of bleak, really. You would have liked to think there's some sort of final moment for him, but no, he just.
Well, the other two have died in a visual way, but as I said earlier, Aaron, I guess, I'm thinking about it, I haven't read it for the first time, is that. You're having to read between the panels, but you're using your own imagination.
Yeah.
So Chris Claremont is allowing you, and however dark your imagination, or even light, let's be fair, imagination is, to have that. And why not? You've had various ways of being killed here.
Exactly. But it's just the way he puts it. You know, it's like. It's so harsh, but it's also it's kind of affecting. It's just he's dead so quickly, and that's it. And then we just see her shed a tear, and literally it's just the only person left is Rachel Summers, and when she's holding the body of Kate Pryde, obviously the empty shell. Because her consciousness is back in time. So yeah, it's basically all up to Kate to save the day. And back to 1980.
Where we see Kate, Kitty, who's come across the evil Destiny, who's basically cornered Senator Kelly with a nasty looking crossbow. And it's all about to go horribly, horribly wrong.
But she saves. But basically, yeah. Should we say what happens, or should we leave it for folks? Should we leave it?
I think yes. Let's leave it there. Read the book to find out what happens at the end.
Yeah.
Because we're basically at well, pretty much.
Yeah, there are a few more pages, but it's the final confrontation. So. Yeah, we cut it, and it's so what we have is a two issue story, which is really quite powerful. I mean, literally, it actually that's what it says on the tin. Everybody dies.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the only person left alive in the future is the sort of unconscious body of Kate Pryde and Rachel Summers. So yeah, it's a lie. Why didn't they die as well? Horribly. I want blood.
Well, you could read between the panels.
Yeah,
and in her grief.
Yes. Look into your heart. You'll see what happens.
But then again, yeah, just read the book and get. But at that point, it is doom and gloom. It is one of the most doom-esque and gloom-esque.
Obviously, you know, comics. We get that sort of. Post Frank Miller, post Watchmen, post Dark Knight Returns, we get the kind of grimming up, I guess, of superheroes. In the 90s, we've kind of referred to it. You know, suddenly everyone gets dark and angsty and wears a lot of bandoliers with pouches and dark leather jackets and starts carrying more firearms. And superheroes have no compunction about killing anymore. You know. Heroes who maybe have been a bit on the periphery, like the Punisher, become massively big characters. Wolverine In this story, Wolverine is just one of the team.
Yeah.
But he really, you know, with storylines like Weapon X, basically, you know, Wolverine is sort of gets his powers, you know, basically his mutant power is healing, but then they lace his skeleton with adamantium, which is incredibly strong metal, to turn him into an assassin, essentially.
Mm.
I mean, it's all that, you know, they always kind of skirted around the comics code, because if you've got someone who has massively kind of unbreakable metal claws, how do you use those things? You use them by clawing people, but obviously they don't show lots of blood and guts and people being killed generally.
Mm.
But then you start to get things like the again Claremont and Miller Wolverine series. I mean, even then, you know, they don't really have gore, but you actually have Wolverine killing people.
Yeah, it's very subtly done in things like the Claremont Miller book, and certainly in this one as well. It's not necessarily done off panel, but things like say the death of Storm, where she is effectively skewered all the way through. It's done in silhouette. You can see what's happened, but there's no, you know, there's no gore flying everywhere. It's just there as a.
Yeah, and Wolverine is actually smashing some robots, some programmed mindless robots, and in a previous X-Men as well, he actually went to it was part of Dark Phoenix. He actually goes to chop this guy's arm off, but you find he's actually an android.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, oh, okay, that's fine. You're not going to have a severed arm, blood everywhere. Okay. So I guess, yeah, I'd ever consider that as...
Yeah,
but safe-ish.
Really. It's true, but I mean, in Claremont, they start to bring this thing in with, like, I think it's Storm in particular is kind of like always trying to stop Wolverine from killing people, you know. But and they do things like, you know, like Wolverine will find or sort of get someone who needs killing and basically just put his fist up against their stomach, and then you just get on the comic book panel snicked, and you know what's happened. It's clever and it's pretty cold, you know. So they start to bring these kind of themes in. So I guess the question is, you know, what is the kind of legacy of this story apart from this new movie? You know, there have been direct sequels. Claremont has come back to us, particularly in the pages of Excalibur, which is one of the sort of mini X books. It's sort of X-Men became a massively popular book in the 1980s. It goes absolutely crazy. I mean, that's when I got into it, into the quote-unquote copper age. You get you know, Young Mutants. You get X-Factor, which is not the singing mutants as you might think, but it's the kind of reunited team of the original X-Men. They're all back together again. Yes, even Jean Grey, who's alive again at that point. Although at various points Angel gets turned into Archangel, there's lots of kind of tortured sort of soap opery things going on. It's all fantastic stuff. You've got X-Force, but yeah, Excalibur was the one that took place on British soil
with Captain Britain.
Yeah, and yeah, also I think Kitty Pryde part of that group.
She is, yeah.
But that's written by Claremont, and again that really goes into that sort of future timeline, and actually sort of just eventually sort of ties things up in that version of the future. So I guess if you're looking to sort of read the continuity, you get X-Men Days of Future Past, X-Men Days of Future Present. There's also a kind of like a Wolverine, I think, solo sort of story arc which takes place in that, and then you've got this sort of run on Excalibur, which really goes into that, where the whole team travel into that alternative future to try and sort things out.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Claremont doesn't throw things away. That's another thing we should mention about the kind of storytelling here is that Claremont was very good at sort of almost. It's like we're used to these things in kind of sort of movie franchises now, but it's this method of storytelling where you sort of. You set things up and then you just kind of leave them dangling. There's lots of kind of dangling kind of hooks of kind of like a superhero starts build a supervillain starts building something which could be incredibly detrimental to the human race, and then we don't hear about it for years, and then we come back to them later,
mm.
or or we, the reader, find out that you know, a particular character is actually the son or daughter of an evil mutant, but then that they don't know about it, and again, it's, there's lots of these kind of dangling plot threads.
And then that's the sort of thing writers are always going to do, especially when you're trying to bang out books on a monthly basis. You need to have things that you can maybe grab in a go-to file, and that could be stuff that you've either deliberately or kind of forgotten about, left dangling, and it's kind of there, sort of ready to go if you really need inspiration, I guess.
Yeah. So I mean, then they go on to, I mean, Claremont continues to sort of write for the book for many years. Byrne leaves, and it goes on to a sort of celebrated run doing art for the Fantastic Four. And yeah, if you want to get hold of this, it's very easy to get hold of kind of collected editions, as we were saying. You've got sort of trade paperback graphic novel editions, which have the two issues and also some accompanying stories. There's a hardcover you can buy, which is about £30, which also has some of this kind of sequel material and additional bits and pieces. And obviously it's all gorgeous, but, and there's also a sort of pocket version, which is probably the cheapest version of buying it in a paper format, which you can get for £6.99, which is kind of an A5 size, which is quite nice.
It's kind of nifty, actually. It's a nice little version.
Yeah, and yes, and electronic versions are available, are they not?
Absolutely, yeah. Comixology has got a very nice little version of it. Obviously, the Marvel online store also has it. It looks great on a tablet. It's just, again, so it works very, very nicely. You can read that page by page or do the whole guided view thing, but yeah, other options are available. There's no excuse for you not to grab it.
I mean, if you do sort of dip into this, you'll find that it is, you know, it's very self-contained. You can just read these issues and you'll be fine. You'll know where you was, because there is so much exposition, and kind of they really had this idea that every comic someone picks up might be someone's first ever comic. Which is really key. So you do tend to get these kind of recap panels, these explanations of who people are when we see them, what their powers are. You know, they do explain things.
They do, and explain things, and explain things.
And explain things. But so, but if you decide you want more, I mean, and there are various kind of, obviously, collected editions of things, but maybe a good way to sort of get into, I guess, the sort of Bronze Age stuff, or the sort of Claremont Byrne run, which is the way I got into it, which is through the classic X-Men series of comics, which is basically in the sort of late 80s, they started reprinting from Giant X-Men 1, all that arc of, you know, of stories which started with that new team of X-Men. So you can follow it all through, and you can get all the sort of Dark Phoenix stuff. But also what they did is they didn't just reprint the issue. You got the issue, and then you got a new backup story written by Chris Claremont. And so it's kind of like setting at exactly that same time, but maybe just following one and solo member of the team who's not featured in that story that much. So it sort of paints in the margins, if you see what I mean. It's really nice. And you'll find that you'll better get those sort of fairly cheapish sort of, you know, back issues in shops, and maybe from Comixology you might be able to get those as well.
Local libraries as well. They do still, and this is where I've had a lot of my great finds over the last few years, is just picking up random, not just Marvel, DC, Vertigo, Image, and all the rest of it, but other more independent titles. Just a call out to local, especially London libraries as well. You can actually get online now, and they have their catalogues on there for all of London. They did that recently. Even though the government have ripped the funding from libraries, and they've had to get and sell a fair few issues here and there off there, especially where I live, I can actually get to at least six or seven libraries and pick up on these comics as well. So support your local library.
Absolutely. That's right. Right. Yeah.
So I guess we're kind of reaching an end, aren't we? So maybe we should recommend some more X-Men titles for people to look at, some more story arcs if they want to sort of go on and read more.
Well, the obvious one to go for would be the Phoenix, Dark Phoenix thing, where Jean Grey stops being the sort of the girl of the team and turns into a rampaging goddess of destruction.
Just power hungry, really. It's actually in that. Yeah, I'd concur with Mr. Wickens. That Phoenix basically got me completely hooked on this comment, and dare I say it, sacrilegious me saying this, but his writing there was actually better than Stan Lee's in the original X-Men for me. Not Stan Lee to suit Spider-Man. I won't go there. But that's brilliant too. But no. Having gone back to that Dark Phoenix recently, just cutting straight to the action, some dark themes, some more mature themes as well, real sense of danger with the villains. Villains who actually do pop up again in years of future.
Yeah, I guess the question is how dated are these stories now? How do they hold up? They are of their time, aren't they?
Yeah, but I still think that some of the Phoenix ones do carry through. It's not too dated as to be quaint.
I think the Silver Age stuff, the 1960s comics, they can be a tough read if you're not sort of prepared for what you're going to get. You get very stylish, very surreal, brilliant imagery, brilliant ideas. It's like lots of the villains and iconography and themes and that get used in the X-Men book are set up in the 60s, but the actual stories they read kind of younger, as though they're for a younger readership than later ones were. So
yeah, and is it of an age? The ones in the 80s are drawn as well for the 80s. So we've still got some flares going on there. We've still got some leather jackets. And hey, we're having a lot of 80s fashion now in 2014. So maybe it hasn't dated that much now, in 5 years' time, it would have dated.
Obviously, we talked a lot about how grim the future is in this, but I think we should, most of us say these are incredibly fun books, aren't they? They're fun.
Absolutely.
They really capture that kind of joy of superhero comics. No matter how angsty they get, no matter how, how much we can say, it's actually about, prejudice and and you can read it as being about racism or about homophobia or anti-Semitism. But really, they're just great fun superhero book titles.
I mean, they're about all that, but they're also about the joy of superpowered individuals slamming up against each other in some very inspired and very innovative ways. I think the fight sequences in X-Men books are just so kinetic and just
and more so than I think than in maybe any other team. Marvel team book, certainly more so than the Avengers, but maybe with the exception of Fantastic Four, then they're about family. Yeah. They're about a group of individuals kind of finding a family with these other people who are in the same boat as them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's it. And no matter which sort of team you're looking at, whether it's whether it's the original X-Men or whether it's the X-Men of the sort of the Bronze Age, of the Copper Age, the X-Men now, whether it's the one that's led by Cyclops or Wolverine or Storm or what have you.
Man, family, this is just so messy, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we won't even get to how kind of tortured the sort of continuity gets and the retcons and so on. Let's just instead concentrate on how fun those books are. And recommend you go and read them. Absolutely. So without any further, I think enough said.
That'll do it.
Yeah,
true believers.
That will do it, true believers. So we must thank our very special guest, Mr. Graham Williams.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for inviting me on and letting me speak. It's been a lot of fun.
Good.
And it remains to be seen whether we've now affected the future. And let's hope, fingers crossed, that we've saved the world. So I think it's time to jump back into our you know, and let our present day selves take over the bodies. So when are we starting to record the podcast then? What's that? An hour? An hour and a half?
An hour and 35? Grief. Well,
did it go well, Graham?
How was it?
Was it alright?
Yeah, alright. Should we start again?
Wow, okay. Let's hope that was okay. And I don't know, I just felt funny for a second and then we've lost an hour and a half.
Sounds like my Friday night.
Well, with that bombshell, I think it's time to say...
Speak to you soon.
Excelsior!